Well, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Dan Renshaw. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, Mike.
So the last session finished with kind of a not quite a cliffhanger, but a
we've got Billy Martin. He's standing there on Skyscraper Mountain, and we use the word astounded, which I don't think is a misuse at all. Let me back up just a few minutes, Mike, and tell everybody where we are standing.
Okay.
As a collective group, we've just exited the visitor center.
Right.
At the Independence Mine State Historical Park. And we're standing in the, part of the north, our upper parking lot, just to the east of the camp itself, the mining camp. And we're standing there looking west. And the west wall that we're looking at is composed of Skyscraper Mountain and Granite Mountain. And between the two, there's a very interesting feature called a rock glacier that has been generally known as Carl's Gulch. So standing there, we've been looking up primarily putting our focus on the Skyscraper Mountain. It was first. Hatcher walked from Hatcher's Pass along the ridgeline that became known as Skyscraper Mountain, and then the actual high point of that ridge is Skyscraper Peak.
Okay.
Standing there, he looked down on the east side of the mountain and saw what could be called a ledge of quartz sticking out of the mountainside. Shouldn't have been there. The glaciers were pretty, pretty brutal on the mountainsides. They did a lot of carving when the valley was full of ice. And why this particular feature had been left is really a strange thing, but it's sticking out like the proverbial sore thumb. And he can see it's quartz, and it catches his attention. Hatcher now is a prospector. The year is either 05 or 06. He descends the mountain on the east side just a couple of hundred feet to get to this ledge, can see visible gold in it. This must have been a really interesting exposure. Big, 10 feet, 8 to 10 feet probably of quartz with gold, visible gold in it. He then sells that to a group in Seattle that one of the members is the name William Martin, and Billy Martin is an attorney. And it's hard to piece together if he's the attorney of the group or if he's part of the group. But nonetheless, he asks the old due diligence questions. Fine, I can see here in Seattle these rocks you've brought down. Have you ever been to the site? He's quizzing whomever brought the project to him.
Right.
But they bought it, and they don't know that much about it. And so Billy, he figures it's incumbent upon him that he better go take a look at what. And this is 1908 now.
Right.
So he comes up, takes a look, and we left off last time with him standing there looking at this thing, and he is pretty astounded that it's beyond what he thought it was.
Okay.
Now, Billy is not a mining person. He's an attorney. But in the next few years, he makes a tremendous transformation. He brings himself up to speed on both mining and milling. And how he goes about all of this is a real mystery to me. He probably has some really good people that he's found to come with him to Alaska. Because he is so excited about the project that he negotiates with the now owners of Hatcher's Discovery, he negotiates a lease, and he himself is going to do the mining. So he shows up as lease begins in July of 1912 and will run until 20. And he brings in, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself because that prior to Billy, Carl had come into the district. And Carl had made a decent road. So now when Billy Martin shows up in 1912, he's got a road capable of hauling his equipment up and parts for his mill, everything you need for doing underground mining. cables for access for aerial tramways. All of this is hauled into the district on Carl's Road. he sets up his mill right at the bottom of Skyscraper Mountain and in Fishhook Creek. He has educated himself sufficiently to understand the complicated problems with water for using power from water in that area. So one of the things he brings in is, I believe it was like a 20-horse industrial gasoline engine, which in those days weighed about 2 tons.
Oh, you know, okay.
You picture these huge flywheels and so on both sides, and a single huge piston going back and forth, everything oversized in order to get 20 horsepower, probably turning a couple of hundred RPM. He brings that in, so by gosh, he isn't going to be held hostage by low water. But he also brings in the Francis turbine and makes a penstock and takes all the water he can from every source he can and dumps it into his penstock so that he can turn the wheels on his Chilean mill. Now, the residual of all of this, Mike, you can see in the creek. You have to walk down Fishhook Creek from the Independence Mine buildings, quarter mile, something like that, not more than that.
And the creek at this point, remind me, I'm looking at it. I'm saying it's actually on the east side of the road. Is that not right?
The Fishhook Creek forks down by the Hatch Pass Lodge. The what would be the east fork is actually technically Goldcord Creek, and the old maps, it's called Goldcord Creek.
Okay.
Cord spelled with an H, C-H-O-R-D. The West Fork then becomes the Fishhook Creek. It's right at the bottom of the mountain. Flows right through the camp, you know.
Right. I've seen it. There's a little bridge there.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, if you, after you've examined the buildings and read all the signs, why wander down Fishhook Creek and you'll come to these concrete footings in the creek. And that was all that's left of Martin's Mill. It had a long, illustrious history, built the beginning in 1912 and finally burned in a fire in, I believe it was 41. And at that time, it had been upgraded and was being used, and it was very important to the Independence Mine.
Right.
But Hatcher does really amazingly well. He is up on the mountain. He has men building his mill. All of this intended to be seasonal now, so nothing is undercover. It's all open. There's tarps over selected parts of it and so on. But for the most part, everything is open and exposed to rain, sun, weather of all kinds. He has a gas engine, so he can run a little. He can start earlier, he can run a little later, but he can't deal with winter conditions. It's just too harsh. So, again, the seasonal thing before World War One, everything was very seasonal.
Okay.
He starts out this summer, Mike. Let's take a hike, and I'll take you up the, what would now be over 100-year-old trail that Martin made, zigzagging back and forth up the mountain to his workings on, it's all on Skyscraper Mountain, but it is a complicated thing because he finds another vein, and he calls it the Homestead Vein, and he stakes claims that have that name. Later, much, much later, it's found out to be the Independence Vein, the vein that made the Independence Mine.
Okay.
And it had some value on Skyscraper Mountain also.
So let's pause just a quick moment there, because what you've raised in my mind is the question of when you place a claim on a place or a vein, how is it determined that the ownership goes in a certain direction with the vein or the ground above it? Or how's that work?
Well, the way it's supposed to work, you give it your best shot as to determining the strike and dip of the vein. Strike being the important thing, because you have to stake, in order to get the full benefit of the mining law, you have to stake your long lines of your mining claims parallel with the exposure of the vein, the outcrop of the vein.
Okay.
So if the vein is striking north-south, right. And let's say that the outcrop is visible, you've exposed it in several locations, and let's say it's roughly north-south, then you're staking either side of that, wanting the vein to be in the middle. Of the claim.
Right.
Now, then your end lines have to be parallel with each other. And this gives you what is known as the law of the apex under the federal mining law. And it allows you to mine that vein to the, quote-unquote, center of the earth. If in mining the vein, you wander off of your property lines, which are, for all practical purposes, you can call them vertical.
Okay.
If you wander off that, it doesn't matter, because you own the extralateral right if you've staked your claim correctly. So if there's I'm not going to call it a science or anything technical. It's an art. A good prospector had a sixth sense how to do this in order to get the full benefit of the mining law. And you'd stake your claim. You had to put notices up. You had to put rock cairns up that were 3 feet high,
okay. So
that they were very obvious, and you'd put claim notices in the corners, usually in a tobacco can. That became the essential thing for staking a mining claim, was a Prince Albert tobacco can, which was used for, it was supposed to be pipe tobacco, but of course they rolled their own cigarettes. So there was an abundance of these little cans that fit very nicely in your chest pocket.
Sure.
So those would be collected, and when you were going to stake a claim, you'd put your claim notices in that and in this rock cairn. And that was noticed to everybody else that, this, by gosh, this is your stuff. Then you had to go record it in the recording office, and that was further noticed to the world.
So you were talking about a vein.
He finds this lower vein. It's lower than the vein that they're there to mine.
Okay.
And he does, sinks again a winds development on this vein in two different locations because his mill isn't ready. So he's got to be doing some mining up on top. He's trying to figure out what he's going to do next. And he has several crews, and they're, one's putting up a cable for a collection system where they can put the ore together to transport it down to the mill. He has an abundance of sources where he's going to be extracting his ore. By late summer, he's got his mill running, so he's sending ore down the mountain in several different ways.
Okay.
His mining is very complicated on this property, but he starts off with this independent, what he calls then homestake vein. He starts off mining that and transporting the ore down the hill. Now, when we walk up this summer on the trail, we're going to find an old rail line. The rail's gone now, but you can see the ties that goes across the face of Skyscraper Mountain that you'd never know was there until you walked it. And at the end of that, there's an ore transfer location where he ran this ore car down there, transferred the ore down below, and I'm not sure what he was doing, but I think he was using Carl's old mill, and we'll have to go back to that because... Mm-hmm. Carl had come and gone by the time Billy Martin shows up in 1912. But Billy runs his mill, does his mining, extracts the majority of the ore that is readily available on Hatcher's Find, which the vein gets all kinds of names attached to it, the Skyscraper Vein, the Martin Vein, etc. But this upper vein, which later was found out to be, pretty much proven to be, we had mentioned this discovery on Granite Mountain, which right. Now I'm trying to segregate, but I'm bringing back in over on the, as you're standing there looking west, it's the large mountain on your right.
Okay.
And up high, you remember the first discovery we had talked about, the Barthoff family finding that and naming it the Independence.
Right.
And because of the remembrance of the startling discovery down in Colorado that made what was known as the Independence Mine. But that's the same vein as what Martin is mining that Hatcher had discovered.
Okay.
So anyway, Martin does all this milling. He's in the district in a big way for the next 8 years. The numbers are a little hard to come by, Mike, hard to believe. He milled something like 22,000 tons. And you realize this is seasonal. And so, that's a fairly long season to get that done. I don't think in the early days his mill was more than 40 tons per day. So that's a substantial amount, but, you know, in order to get 22,000 tons through seasonally, you do the math, and he's a busy guy.
Absolutely.
Bringing ore down the mountain and getting that mill running 24/7 and getting a recovery. From that, he recovers 28,000 ounces. So he's recovering now the first pass through his mill, which is nothing but mercury. He has done a plating test at Carl's old mill. He knows it'll plate, and so he's using mercury for recovery. Later, he'll do some cyaniding, and so the numbers are a little hard to understand as to, is the 28,000 just the mercury, or does that include the cyaniding of his tailing pond also? But nonetheless, it's an amazing...
So this is an ounce, 28,000 ounces of...
Of gold.
Gold.
Yeah. Now, at today's price, say $1,000 per ounce, you're talking, $28
million. Yeah. Right.
So he's doing well. He's spending lots of money getting this done. Of course, he's earning $20.67 per ounce in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But he's spending before the war, his labor is quite cheap.
Right.
Everything is fairly economically priced. He mills right through World War I, and as he does so, why materials are hard to come by, iron and steel products primarily. And after the war, he's got a lot of inflation that he's fighting, but he continues through all of that, and he's successful. You find him involved in a lot of other properties around the mining district. He gets his name included on them, some of it having to do with patenting processes and so on. And because he's an attorney, these are easy things for him to pursue.
Do.
Yeah. So okay. He does that. he's also, because it's so close, we're going to get back to the involvement of the discovery of the gold cord mine. One of his mill men is one of the Barthoff family, a young man at the time, who spends his off hours prospecting in the Fishhook Valley and finds the gold cord veins. He enlists Martin's help on getting that initially milled through the Martin mill, but I'm getting a little off here. I wanted to continue with depleting, if we can, Skyscraper Mountain.
Okay, let's go for it.
So we've got Martin working on the property. That doesn't exhaust the deposit. when he's done, he probably wishes he had a little more time, because they have to walk away leaving a little bit behind. But that just entices others later. Nothing really happens on the skyscraper property then until quite late. We've mentioned this big change in everything that takes place just after World War I, where the people that had left for the war never came back, most of them. We don't know where in the world they just found a better life elsewhere. If you were in the war and you got sent to France, and why, you probably had broader horizons upon leaving France than going back to Alaska and throwing your, how does Robert's service say it, throw my youth in the grave,
Oh. You
know, it's that type of thing. So anyway, they never came back. So the skyscraper mountain becomes quiescent. There's not much happening on it after Billy Martin leaves. Now, let's transfer over. Let's shift our gaze. Remember, we're still standing outside the visitor center
right
at the park, and we've been looking at Skyscraper Mountain. Let's shift our attention a few degrees to the right and look at Granite Mountain. And let's refresh here. In 07 was the first staking of the claims high on Granite Mountain by the name of the Independence vein, Barthoff family. Same year, Barthoff family finds what a lower vein they call the Granite Mountain vein. In a group then takes over this these claims, and their man on the property, his last name is Carl. And Carl comes in with all kinds of equipment. He's got a three-stamp mill, 500-pound stamps. And again, Mike, everything that they brought in the way of equipment was so heavy duty. It just wore you out looking at it, let alone how in the world did they move that. I feel so sorry for the horses that had to pull it up the hill, for God's sake. But anyway, he brings in a three-stamp mill, which is a prospecting mill. It's not big enough to do any production. He's just prospecting. And he and Martin get acquainted in probably 08 or 09 when Martin comes up to take a look. And so that's when he does his plating in Carl's mill. And then in 09, Barthoff now, they have been making discovery after discovery. We had mentioned the bullion mine, which they found, and it was by far the richer of all of them. Mm-hmm. And so the Barthoffs only have capital to develop one of these. They decide to develop the bullion. And they lease option then the other properties on Granite Mountain. Carl is present from 08 to 11. 1908 to 1911, and he does a lot of underground work on both the upper vein, the Independence, and the lower vein, the Granite Mountain. And he does a little bit of milling in his mill in 08 when he first got his mill up and running. It was late in the season, and he claimed a recovery of 87 ounces,
Yeah.
That's nice, but
proof of concept.
Yeah, exactly. He had to show something for his efforts. And whoever's funding him, they allow him to come back for the next couple of years. And we don't know, we don't have any numbers on how much ore he actually milled. We know that he did mill ore from the upper vein, the Independence, and he did mill ore from the Granite Mountain vein. Somewhere in this period of time, the property takes on the name of the Independence, and that name kind of slips down the mountain and gets attached to the lower vein, which becomes then the Independence vein. It's not clear how this all happened, but the Independence mine and the Independence vein and so on are not the same as they originally were staked.
Okay.
Kind of an interesting little side feature here. We don't know exactly what happened to Carl Weather, he got tired of the whole thing. They lost their lease. It's not real plain, but then another individual shows up by the name of Milo Kelly. And Kelly has some grand ideas for developing both the skyscraper vein. He makes projections that the skyscraper vein has got to go into the mountainside. It's got to be available at the bottom of Skyscraper Mountain on the west side, which is the upper Willow Creek drainage. It's the drainage over the hill from where we're standing at the visitor center. So he runs a long tunnel in from that side, expecting to intersect the extension of the downslope extension of the skyscraper vein. He never finds it because between the two, he had not identified what later became known as the Martin Fault. And the Martin Fault did a lot of displacing of the mountainside, and it cut off all of the veins and made for a termination point for mining pretty much everything. But he kind of, a lot of effort. Now we're talking in these days of hand drilling. Imagine a mining phase where the miners, if you're double jacking, you've got one guy holding the drill rod and he's turning it after every blow by the other guy who's putting all of his effort into swinging a large sledgehammer against that blunt end of the drill steel. Now, a drill steel, if you've got a really good blacksmith, he can put a chiseled bit on a drill steel that might last you for a foot, maybe 2 feet if you're really good at it. It can't be, it's got to be sharp.
Right.
But if you temper it incorrectly, it'll be brittle and you'll get chips off of it and it'll quickly dull. If you temper it incorrectly in the other direction, it'll get dull just from the wear and tear. But a good blacksmith, and I've watched them in the early days as a kid as to what they were doing, sharpening picks and drill steels and so on. And you had to have a dark room. You'll notice blacksmith shops never have windows in them. You had to have a dark room because when you pull that steel out, you'd go through the forge twice, the first time to sharpen it, to get the chisel end on it that you wanted, and then you'd reheat it for tempering. And when you pulled it out, it had to be a certain color. Then you'd plunge it into, and different blacksmiths had different ways of doing this, an oil bath or a water bath, pull it out, and watch then as this cherry red would work its way from the rod, is the base of the rod, back up to that point. And then just at the right point, he would quench it again. And this would give him the right crystal structure in that piece of steel that it had a chance of drilling for a foot or two by this old method of swinging a sledgehammer.
So dimensions of the tunnel that was going to be hand chiseled, how tall and how long?
The nominal, it's called nominal 5x7. Okay. You want to stand up in it. I mean, gosh, it's a little effort to make it high enough to stand up in. So you're going nominally first. You call it 5x7, which means all of the intricacies of the rock, you're probably more like 4x6. You better wear your hard hat inside, you know. And what they're drilling, of course, is blast holes.
Right.
So you only have enough room at the face for two men to work in a 5x7. So they're drilling a pattern of about 12 holes. And they're only going, I can't imagine how they could do this, Mike, but they can get 12 2-foot deep holes in a face in a day. Yeah, and this is solid rock. For example, Milo Kelly's work was a crosscut, so it's in solid granite all the way looking for the vein that'll come down, hopefully, and they'll cross. And this hard granite is just that. It is really tough stuff, but it's friable. It will chip when you hit it sufficiently with the, if you're doing this yourself, it's called single jacking. If you're doing it with a helper who's twisting and holding, why, it's double jack.
And then it's blasted, and then all of that rubble is removed. And
right.
About how much depth would you get from a blast?
Well, the 2 foot.
That's it
for the day. So you're talking about later when you've got some pneumatic tools that are
sure.
invented. First, they're steam tools,
right.
And then there are pneumatic tools. The miners don't like them because, like everything that comes up from this period of time that comes up to the mine, it is just enormously heavy. These things are just outrageously heavy. As time goes on, very quickly they perfect pneumatic tools. Better metallurgy primarily is what's needed to make a tool that will reciprocate and turn both. And all you're doing is scaling up the single jack, double jack, because a pneumatic drill is giving you not just a blow per second or so. It's giving you a bunch of them, and
right.
they're not the massive blows from a sledgehammer, but they're smaller. You got a smaller pneumatic piston that's hitting and doing the, but you got so many of them.
Right.
And then you've got a continuous rotation, so that chisel bit is not making a incisement in the hole. It's turning, and so you're getting a chipping. And then you have to have now, with pneumatic tools, you have to have a hollow drill steel because you've got to blow air through that in order to get the cuttings out. And, of course, they learn the hard way that there's such a thing called silicosis, that the dust coming out of the hole has a high silicon content, and when that gets in the miner's lungs, he's not going to last long.
So Dan... On that note, we have come to the end of another session, and it's probably just thinking about the process you've described. Time for a little rest before we continue.
Oh, okay. We'll continue next time, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.